The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Have you ever heard anybody use the word Luddite?
Yes.
Do you know what it means?
Someone who doesn't like cell phones or computers or ordering stuff online.
I think it's someone that's like not involved with technology, right? They're like the people that still write in a day planner rather than, you know, use their phone or their iPad or anything like that.
Everybody. I don't know anybody who I would call a Luddite who's still alive today.
I didn't even know what a Luddite was.
A Luddite.
That would be my mother.
Like when you had your, remember when you had your brick phone? I called you a Luddite.
You did. Yeah.
Or like me now.
Can't get behind the idea of online dating? Rather write a letter than send an email, listen to music on vinyl? Any of these could get you branded as a Luddite, whatever that means.
You know, it's a really common catch-all for anyone who's a technophobe or, you know, even bad at technology. So you'll hear people who aren't on Facebook called Luddites.
That's Brian Merchant, senior editor for Motherboard. We spoke to him by Skype, by the way, which proves that he is not afraid of new technology. He's interested in the real Luddites, as in the 19th century movement that was armed, secretive, and ultimately mounted large-scale riots.
What they were doing wasn't protesting technology per se. They were protesting the effect that technology was having on their livelihoods.
Luddites, inspired by the Robin Hoodish, perhaps mythical folk hero Ned Ludd, were responsible for smashing the assembly lines of their day, stocking frames and other machines that threatened to make textile workers obsolete. These weren't people who couldn't figure out how to program the Blu-ray player. The Luddite insurrection was fierce. At one time, there were more British soldiers fighting Luddites than Napoleon's army in the Iberian Peninsula. And it was violent, and it was about jobs, not convenience. In the end, thousands of factory stocking frames were smashed to bits, and a number of Luddites were executed by the crown. Brian says some people still use the term Luddite correctly, but it's usually by accident. For example, musician Tom York of Radiohead, a self-proclaimed Luddite, once famously railed against the impact of Spotify and other streaming services on the music industry. Brian says that's actually a reasonable analogy, because York isn't complaining that Spotify is too hard to use or that music sounds better on vinyl. York says that streaming services are killing the music industry and threatening jobs.
You know, technology is a thing, it's a force that's scary to a lot of people, especially to people who view it deterministically. They take some solace in the fact that if they were to pull the plug and walk away, you know, maybe things could, to some extent, go back to the way things were. It fuels a lot of conservative thinking, in my opinion. To be a Luddite is to reject this brave new world.
All signs point to that brave new world sticking around. Moby, for one, says Tom York griping about Spotify is akin to, quote, an old guy yelling at fast trains. And maybe that's true, but it doesn't mean people don't agree with him. Clearly, our devices are changing the way we think and behave. And there are plenty of people who embrace the latest apps and watch movies on their tiny screens, but are nevertheless drawn to the idea of life without digital appendages. We're calling them the new Luddites. Loads of people, from digital natives to millennials to boomers, who feel nostalgic for the simple way that life used to be, whether that's real or imagined. Today we have stories about a few of those people and about some of the old school objects that drive their fascination with the past. So we're starting with the Mason Jar. Arianna Kelly is a writer and author, and her article, The Mason Jar Reborn, appeared in The Atlantic. She spoke with producer Taylor Quimby about its newly vaunted role in popular culture.
So tell me a little bit about the Mason Jar's origin story. Where did it come from?
Sure. Well, people have been trying to preserve food against the natural processes of decay for a long time, of course, but canning and the mason jar as we know it really arose in the early 1800s during the Napoleonic Wars. And these were wars that were fought for many years by men who were on long deployments. And because of the length of their deployment, they really only had access to food that was smoked, cured, dried. Because of that, after a while, they just didn't have access to the nutrients they had. They started suffering from scurvy and malnutrition. And the French government decided to issue a contest where I think they offered a reward of 10,000 francs, I believe, for the person who could come up with the best process to preserve foods. And it turns out that a man named Nicolas Appert, who's a French cook, had been working on this problem for quite some time. And his proposal was essentially to boil food in jars and then seal these jars and prevent them from coming into contact with air. He actually started with champagne bottles and sort of sealed them with a sort of improbable mixture of cheese and lime.
Mm.
And he won. And then about 30 years later, or 40 years later in 1858, a man by the name of John Landis Mason, who's actually from New Jersey, invented a jar that had a wider neck and a rib neck and a top that could seal tight. So essentially what he did is he refined a process that had been fairly prone to error. And in the early 20th century, it became a really integral part of farming culture, especially in areas like New Hampshire, where I'm from, that had a really short growing season. It became a really important way for people to have relatively fresh fruits and vegetables in the middle of the winter.
And so how do we get to today, then, where mason jars are once again in vogue? Is this part of our recent fascination with everything old-fashioned, like artisanal ice, bow ties, that sort of thing?
I think it's definitely part of it. I mean, one of the reasons is that local food in general has had a resurgence thanks to writers like Alice Waters and Michael Pollan and Dan Barber, among many others. People are aware of the tremendous amount of resources that goes into making food and also transporting it and the kind of carbon imprint that leaves. And there's been a return to trying to, you know, create more locally grown produce. There's also, you know, a number of ways in which the mason jar has been repurposed. So if you Google the mason jar, you can find mason jar terrariums, beakers, soap holders, what have you. But the other part of this is that mason jars have become sort of synonymous with thrift, preservation, personal labor, and as such, they've become a really potent signifier for people. They, you know, can enjoy a cocktail in a mason jar and sort of borrow some of the cultural aura that the mason jar has. One thing I noticed recently, and The Atlantic did run a follow-up piece about this, is that Jeb Bush is now using the mason jar as part of his campaign. I think he's using it as sort of some sort of tchotchke that he's distributing to people. So it's pretty funny.
A mason jar with the lowercase Jeb with the exclamation point?
Maybe. I actually haven't looked at how he's using it. I just thought that he is using it, you know, to kind of milk that kind of folksy down home.
Yeah, you'd think this would be Bernie Sanders territory.
I know. Well, I think it's probably a very conscious choice on Jeb Bush's marketing team, right?
Oh, wow. But, you know, it's funny because like so many hipster trends or anything that's trendy, I suppose, you know, I think about a cocktail in a mason jar and there's part of me that thinks, oh, that's kind of cool. And then there's another part of me that's just kind of grossed out in some way that's hard to describe. So are we seeing a backlash at all to the sort of mason jar repurposing that's going on right now?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a backlash to any sort of hipster trend you see. So a couple years ago, there was a 7-Eleven marketing strategy that made a mason jar Slurpee containers.
That really defeats the purpose, doesn't it?
It really does, right. And Gawker ran a piece on this, and it just inspired, you know, a train of 200 or 300 comments, mostly about who, in fact, uses mason jars and who's entitled to use them. And I think the issue with having, you know, drinking cocktails out of mason jars or your Slurpees or what have you is that it divorces the mason jar from its original context, which is rooted in functionality, in ensuring that in a time of need there will be plenty.
But what will probably happen is at some point it will stop being trendy, but the mason jar will still have that function. It won't go away because, you know, people still do use it for canning.
Yeah, I mean, I think the mason jar is going to outlast whatever hipster trend is making it currently popular and then have a downturn in popularity because, you know, its usefulness is intrinsic. And I think given the current conditions of climate change, the sense that we may not always have as many resources as we'd like or we need is certainly present in our minds, and that those times of need are the times in which a mason jar is really at the peak of its usefulness.
Yeah. So you grew up in New Hampshire. You're in LA now. Is that right?
I am.
Do you ever have the urge to start canning some fruits and veggies, get back to your Granite State roots?
I absolutely do, but I live in a one-bedroom apartment, and the only land outside of my house is just one strip of dirt.
Well, it sounds like you're going to be drinking wine out of your mason jars for a while.
Right, exactly.
All right, Arianna Kelly, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Taylor Quimby there speaking with Arianna Kelly. Coming up, a man who has made a business selling artisanally sharpened pencils is promoting the new season of his TV show with an analog social media campaign. Our search for the new Luddite continues in just a moment. Magic mason jar. Oh no. I ain't never run like old Billy Dunn when he caught him in the wood. Well, he ran till he fell, and I was sitting in the spell and said he'd make more when he could. But a friend of mine. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today we're talking about what we are calling the new Luddite, people like David Reese.
I don't really know if I'm a Luddite. Like, I have an iPhone. I have a laptop computer. I have a lot of fun on those devices. They can be very useful, but I'm very aware of the fact that I probably spend more time on those devices than is good for me.
David doesn't reject the conveniences of modern technology, but like many others, feels profound nostalgia for life before the internet. And so, to promote the second season of his television show, Going Deep, David didn't try to build buzz on Facebook or Twitter, as is the norm today. Instead, he orchestrated a so-called analog social media campaign.
This idea of driving across the country and putting up flyers and kind of getting out of my comfort zone, I think for me is kind of like, it's kind of like a mental health strategy in addition to being a promotional strategy.
David Reese is an author and the owner of an artisanal pencil sharpening company. We'll get more on that in a minute. And the host of Going Deep. That's a show that tackles complex topics like how to make an ice cube or how to flip a coin or how to tie your shoes. I spoke with him as he was gearing up for the second season premiere.
We've decided that instead of trying to spread the word about our TV show via Facebook and Twitter and stuff, to just spread the word the way people used to get the word out, which is just stapling flyers to telephone poles, going around and meeting people, talking to undecided viewers, so to speak, about why they should watch our show.
How many people can you reach that way?
I don't know. This is going to be interesting. Back in the 90s, I'm old, so back in the 90s when I would play in bands or, you know, organize things, we would do it all via flyers. It was an incredible technology, and unlike Twitter or Facebook, you really have no idea how many people are looking at it or how effective it is.
Mm.
Whereas now, the thing that drives me crazy about digital social media is it's so obvious if your tweet was successful because you can see how many people favorited it or retweeted it, and I find that all very stressful. So the thought of having to do another round of digital social media to promote our show made me anxious. I thought I'd rather just get in a car and go put up posters and hope for the best.
I just hope that all of the utility poles are empty for you now. There's not a lot of competition for staple
well,
flyers.
Well, I see that's very interesting because I've been looking at telephone poles very closely recently, and you do see, you know, when you go up to a telephone pole and you get close and you realize there's 10 million rusted old staples on it.
Yeah.
Those staples are all from like 20 years ago now. Those are artifacts, because when's the last time somebody actually put up a flyer on a telephone pole instead of just making an event page on their Facebook account? So depressing. So all those telephone poles are about to get a fresh coat of flyers.
Well, when I hear analog social media campaign, I think, you know, the cynical part of me thinks, what is this? Is just a gimmick. Is this a joke? I mean, you're really going to do this?
No, we're literally, yeah, we're totally going to do this. I have my staple gun. We're picking up the flyers. Yeah, sure, there's an element of humor to it. But I've never driven all the way across the country before, which is a little shameful, I think, for a man my age. And again, it just seems more fun to do this than to sit on my sofa hitting refresh on my Twitter feed hoping that somebody famous and powerful retweeted my dumb tweet asking them to watch my TV show.
What do the flyers say?
The flyers say, everybody watch Going Deep with David Reese. They have a list of all the episode topics. They actually, we bought a burner phone, you know, like a temporary telephone.
Right. Uh-huh.
And we have little tags at the bottom of the flyer that you can tear off to call the phone for more information. Uh-huh. And I'll just talk to people about, I know, it's very nostalgic. I'm taking you back right now.
You really are. It's very old school.
Yeah. So, you know, they can call if they have questions about what's happening or why they should watch the show or why is this flyer in my abandoned parking lot or whatever.
Tell me, what are some of the topics of your upcoming season?
The season premiere is how to bounce a ball.
Whoa.
We also have how to make toast, how to do the dishes, how to get punched. That one was kind of nerve-wracking.
That must have been.
It's actually kind of the best if you don't know you're about to get punched. Sucker punch or being surprised by a punch is ideal.
Really? I thought you had to, like, stiffen up or whatever.
No, the boxer I got punched said to not tense up my muscles. But that, again, he said it's because I don't have any muscles. It was Bernard Hopkins, like a championship middleweight boxer. And he punched me. And, you know, I'm more or less the same.
David Reese, you go deep, obviously.
Yeah, totally. I will do whatever it takes to satisfy my curiosity and that of my viewers. That's my pledge to America.
I'm speaking with David Reese, who is an author and a cartoonist and an owner of a thriving pencil sharpening business, as well as being host of Going Deep. That's a TV show that takes a very, very deep dive into simple tasks like bouncing a ball or making a killer paper airplane. Well, I guess my question is, like, I never thought that there was a lot more to learn about, you know, petting a dog or bouncing a ball, for example.
Right. Well, that's kind of the spirit of the show. You know, we want to take things where you would assume there's nothing to learn and show that if you really do a lot of research, you can look at the world in a different way, you're going to find a lot of amazing science or anthropology or aesthetics, you know, that just about everything is interesting if you really dive in and give it a close look.
Well, and I guess this has kind of worked for you before, that this, I want to go back to your pencil sharpening business, the artisanal pencil sharpening business that you started in 2010. First, could you explain to us what is artisanal pencil sharpening?
It's a very simple business model. People pay me money to sharpen pencils.
Every time their pencil breaks, they send them back to you and they pay what?
That's what I thought would happen. But I think most people never take their sharpened pencil out of the plastic display tube. I think most people never actually deploy their artisanally sharpened pencil. They just keep it as like a conversation starter or a keepsake.
How much does it cost for your artisanal pencil sharpening service?
$40 per pencil.
That's a fair bit of money per pencil. Now, how did this all start?
How did it start? Well, I had a job working for the United States Census just as a door knocker, you know, what they call an enumerator, going from door to door with my pencil and my pad, writing down people's information. But on the first day of staff training, they actually did have us sharpen all these U.S. government-issued unsharpened pencils, and I had so much fun sharpening the pencil, I thought, I wonder if there's a way to get paid to just sharpen pencils. Instead of getting yelled at by people who are terrified of Obama or whatever.
And you figured it out. You
I figured it out.
Started the business.
2,230-something pencils at this point.
But, you know, like, this is another thing that you think, okay, this is a parody, right? This is a joke. Was it a joke?
Was it a joke? No, I mean, it was and it wasn't, you know. It's a real honest-to-God pencil sharpening business. I am pretty good at sharpening pencils. I wrote a 200-page book about pencil sharpening techniques. I've given lots of satisfaction to my customers based on the feedback. And when I toured the country, again, to promote my pencil sharpening book a couple years ago, I had a lot of fun talking to people about pencils and explaining to people how interesting pencils are. So it was, you know, I wanted it to be fun and make people happy, but it was also like there was a serious message behind it, which I guess is also kind of Luddite, you know? People are so overwhelmed and impressed by all these electronic devices, sometimes we forget all the engineering and ingenuity that goes into simple analog devices like pencils.
Okay, so that makes sense. But isn't there something about the quest for artisanal craftsmanship that makes it ripe for parody? I mean, on some level, aren't you making fun of that earnestness of people who reject technology?
Yeah, as someone who eats a lot at a lot of restaurants in New York City, you know, every so often you're like, am I really about to pay $12 for a piece of bread with some butter on it, you know, just because they know what field the wheat came from? There, you know, this stuff can go a little too far. But I think I'm willing to forgive certain overextensions of earnestness and absurdity and cost in the whatever Luddite slash artisan world, because you're pushing back against a family of industries that has so dominated our culture and our the way we think about the world and even the advertisements that we see. I'm talking about companies like Apple, Microsoft, you know, whatever, big tech companies, that obviously any resistance to that or any countermeasure is going to probably have a little absurdity in it, but that's fine because in the end, we're all just going to get crushed by technology.
David Rees, coming to a telephone pole near you. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
You can check out pictures and videos from David's cross-country trip. There's a link to his blog and to the website for Going Deep, where you can see the first episode of the second season. And all of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Contrary to the original Luddite goal of crushing the technology that threatened their livelihoods, David is probably right. It is new technology that's more likely to do the crushing. Certainly, innovations can be transformative, but the shape and scale of that transformation varies widely and is not always for the better. Our next story is about one man's long fight against the tide of technology, and it comes to us from Joe Richman and the Radio Diaries podcast.
When I first met Jimmy Weekly a few years ago, he had put a padlock on his bedroom door and hidden away the key. It wasn't because of my visit, and I don't think he was worried about thieves or even the coal company. More about that in a minute. He did it because that's where his wife Sibby had died, and he just didn't want to go in that bedroom anymore. He wanted it to stay the same. Jimmy Weekly doesn't want things to change in his house. And he doesn't want things to change in Pigeon Roost Hollow in West Virginia. That's where he was born, and that's where he's lived his entire life. Jimmy worked for many years in the coal mines nearby, and he loved working underground. His father was a coal miner, his grandfather, his uncles. Everyone in Pigeon Roost was connected to coal in one way or another. There used to be dozens of houses in this one little part of the valley. Now there's just one. His. In the 1990s, the Arch Coal Company began work on the Spruce No. 1 mine. It was one of the largest mountaintop removal mining sites ever proposed, and it was virtually in Jimmy's backyard. If there's one thing that Jimmy never thought would change, it was the mountain behind his house. Today, much of it's gone. But this is not really a story about fighting the coal company. It's about a simple question. How long do you keep fighting when what you're fighting for is mostly gone?
My name is James Wheatley. I'm standing on the porch in front of my house here in Pigeon Roost Hollow in West Virginia. You can probably hear the string in the background. I'm 71, and I've lived in this hollow all my life. When I was a kid, there was 27 homes in this hollow. My mom and dad lived up the road right here, about 100 feet from here. My first cousin lived right over here. Back down this way, Van Curry and Cecilia Burgess. But right now, no one else lives in this hollow except me, James Wheatley. me and the coal company.
For the last 3.5 years, the top of Blair Mountain has been dug and blasted away. The growth of mountaintop removal has pushed mines close to communities. The coal industry says it is carving away mountaintops and filling valleys with care and precision. But many here worry that there will be a price for permanently altering the landscape.
My name is Joe Lovett. Jimmy and his wife, Sibby, walked into my office in late 1997. I had just become a lawyer. They were my very first clients, actually. And Jimmy had an article about mountaintop removal with him. It was a huge two-page picture, and he pointed to it. You know, there's just destruction all over the picture. He said, I live right there.
The wife and I couldn't sit on the porch for the dust. And the noise, constant. Blasting, tearing my home all to hell. 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Well, next thing I know, my friends was starting to sell. The coal company come in and offered them $70,000, $80,000, and $90,000. They thought that was big bucks. I started going out and talking to these people. I said, hey, please don't sell. This is your roots. You've been here all your life. Hold in there. We can beat this thing. But they all sold out to the coal company.
So Jimmy was the only thing standing between Arch Coal and probably some of the best reserves left in this state. There's no question that they could have sold that land for a lot of money. But he and Sibby stood up to a mining company in a way really that no one had before and said, we're not leaving here and you can't make us.
James Wheatley stands in the way of a planned 3,100-acre expansion by Arch Coal of St. Louis, Missouri. What Wheatley sees as his land, his heritage for his grandchildren, the coal industry sees as buried treasure. Arch Coal can move mountains, but it can't move James Wheatley.
My name is Bill Rainey, and I'm president of the West Virginia Coal Association. The good Lord put the resources in these mountains, and of course it's a huge, huge part of the state's economy, coal in West Virginia. Most everyone have relatives that have something to do with the mining industry. They want to sustain their family. They want a good job. And they're proud of what they do. So Mr. Wheatley became the center of a lot of attention.
Look at me. I'm your neighbor that you put out of work.
We want jobs today. We don't want our families leaving, going to the Carolinas.
Nearing his coal field home, James Wheatley got an unfriendly, screaming, egg-throwing reception.
I'm not out here to take their jobs. I'm out here trying to make a long-term future for my grandchildren, their grandchildren, and everyone else.
Well, do you understand why they're frustrated with you
no,
in particular?
No, not particularly. I do not know.
Mr. Wheatley, for whatever reason, did not sell 12 years on. He remains where he was, and others have moved on.
I'm in my car, a Lincoln Continental Town Car. We're on Route 17 going north, and we're going to pick up some cigarettes. I smoke. This is the town of Blair, West Virginia. There was about 450 homes in here 10, 15 years ago. But look at it now, 30 homes. 30 homes at the most. Virginia Grimes lives right here. That's one of the people who won't talk to me. The boys worked over and got laid off. They had to go somewhere else to get a job. They put the blame on Sibby and I. And they ain't spoke to me since. Yes, ma'am? Give me 5 Winston lights. Thank you, my dear. Hello, Tim. That man right there worked on a mountaintop removal.
Yeah.
This is Timmy Dotson. Tell me your name.
My name's Tim Dotson. I'm from Blair, West Virginia. The last most tranquil place on the earth. Now it ain't even on the map anymore. Go buy a new map today, that town ain't on there.
How come?
Mountaintop removal and coal mine. Coal itself.
Did it create jobs?
That's funny. I helped build that coal mine up there. I helped tear the old one down, build the new one, and still can't get a job.
Well, tell me, do you think that I'm doing the right thing by fighting mountaintop removal? I want the truth. Are you against me?
Well, for it and against it. You know what I mean? It don't matter, Jimmy. Yeah. You ain't going to stop it.
But if we can put a slowdown to it.
It ain't going to happen.
Oh, I have.
Yeah. I can honestly say you slowed it down a time or two.
Yeah.
But you're not going to stop progress, what? Buddy.
Wouldn't you rather
as long as there's coal here, they're going to get it one way or another. On top, underground. They have to have it. Okay? You ain't going to stop it.
Thank you very much, Tammy.
Yeah, not a problem, Don. Be careful.
Ooh. Blasting area. Trespassers will be prosecuted. This is the Spruce Number One mine in Pigeon Roost Holler, right in my backyard. We're looking where they have shot the top of the mountain off to get down to the coal. And that's the way they do it. They just keep the blasting the top off from it. Until this mountain in here, all the way around, is just level. Every bit of this will be level. My great-great-grandpa was the one that owned all this. They come here in 1834, and they settled in Pigeon Roost. He owned this, as far as the eye could see in here. And we called it our mountain. Dana, place on these mountains that we haven't left our footprints. Oh, baby. Thank you for coming over. This is my granddaughter, Alicia Dawn Weekly.
Favorite granddaughter, right?
I love them all. Last count I had was 29.
29
grandchildren. And I think three more's are coming, what I can find out. So I'd make 32.
That's a lot of kids, ain't it? You and Granny built this house, didn't you, Poppy? Mm-hmm.
Yes, we did, baby. Mama put a lot of nails in this house. Sibby Rose Weekly. We was together almost 48 years. I miss her. What do you think about Papa quitting this mountaintop removal and going on with his life?
Papa, you're not selling, right?
I don't know.
You really want to be truthful?
Yeah.
Poppy, I know you get lonely, but I think I would literally cry if you sold. This is where we all grew up. This is where we played. We love it here.
Well, you kids, you don't know what Poppy goes through, living by myself. No one to talk to, day in and day out, looking at the pictures my wife has put up on the wall. I get lonesome. It just takes my heart out of me.
So if Granny was still here, you'd never sell,
I'd
right?
I'd never sell. I'd never sell. There ain't no doubt in my mind.
And you're just lonely.
Yes. I'll be truthful with you, baby. Yes.
You know, it's hard, Poppy. I want you to be happy. I do. I can't blame you. It's just, I don't think you should let them have your house for anything.
Well, I got a big decision to make. Will James Weekly finally give in to the coal company?
Poppy.
Yes, baby.
It was good talking to you. I love you.
I love you too, baby.
All right.
Bye.
Y'all have a good night and have a safe trip back. Take care.
I was born here in Pigeon Roost Holler. I've never been out west, California, Montana. I've never been to them places. But I've always wanted to go on up and see the aspen trees up in Maine. I always did want to go up there and look at them. And then take a plane and go across the waters to the Philippine Islands, all them, visit them. I'd like to go to Paris London. Just travel the rest of my life, enjoy myself. This is what I'm liking to do. But I'd still have Pigeon Roost Holler on my mind no matter where I went. It's hard to get out of a place where you've lived all your life. The old saying is, you always want to come back where your roots are. And I'm just not ready.
And that story was produced in 2011 by Joe Richmond, Samara Freemark, and Sarah Kramer. The Spruce No. 1 mine was one of the largest surface mining projects ever in the United States. But in April of 2013, the EPA won a legal battle that shut most of it down. Jimmy Wheatley stood his ground to the very end and died in August of 2014. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today we're talking about what we are calling the new Luddite, folks who aren't so much fearful of technology as they are infatuated with the idea of what life would be like without it. Well, what could be more representative of this ethos than fantasizing about life with the Amish? That is the attraction of the unlikely literary genre known as Amish fiction, or sometimes called bonnet rippers, with titles like The Quilter's Daughter and The Shunning. These romance novels sell in the millions, more copies than there are actual Amish people in the U.S. So who's doing the buying? Well, a significant audience is among evangelical Christians. Ann Newman is a visiting scholar at the Center for Religion and Media at NYU. She wrote about the rise of Amish fiction for The Baffler. So you took a personal interest in this genre. What is your connection to Amish country and culture?
Well, I've always been fascinated with Amish and Mennonites because I'm from Lancaster County. And so they've always just been part of the environment. My family landed in that little county about 10 generations ago. And so as longtime Mennonites, we've just been in the Anabaptist pool long enough to pay attention to kind of popularization of the faith, as well as kind of the marketing and commerce that is attached to it.
And commerce including these kind of books and novels. What are the sales on these novels?
Oh, it's outrageous. Millions of copies. I think in the article, we note that there was one coming out every 4 days, just millions of copies produced.
Wow.
Annually. And, you know, it's a huge market. We love reading. We forget that as a culture. But evangelical women are reading these, not just because they fill a particular need, but because they're compelling. They're easy to find, and they come in series.
So do they follow the same kind of formula as the ordinary romance novels?
Yeah, absolutely. But the one thing that is exchanged is the type of passion. So we're accustomed to, say, a sexual passion in the standard romance novel format, which two people maybe fall in love, but there are all sorts of problems in the way, and maybe he's not interested, or he's from the wrong family, and the denouement is then these two coming together and really realizing that they are in love and can make it work. So in the standard romance format, we see religious passion then being substituted in these novels. And so, you know, love of Christ is conflated with love of their partner.
How about sexuality? Do they have sex in these books or
no.
Even any kind of passion?
No, they're terribly chaste. Yeah, you know, maybe a brush of the lips, but always regretted. Children are conceived and born, but it's never discussed.
They said they don't actually have sex. Children are just born?
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of erased. It's smoothed over. Very much like an evangelical culture. No one really wants to talk about sex.
Any indication whether Amish people are reading them, perhaps secretly?
Yeah, I think there probably are some. You know, I talked for the article to a scholar named Valerie Weaver-Zerker, and she had done a lot of interviews with both evangelicals and authors and readers, and she found a few Amish, but the Amish tend to kind of giggle at them like, oh, well, that's not really us.
So if the books aren't necessarily for the Amish, who is this evangelical audience? What is their interest in this culture that's so very different from theirs?
Yeah, well, evangelicals are about, they number about 90 million in the United States. And this enormous evangelical culture, which is very reliant on commerce and capitalism for promoting and supporting their own, see these books as kind of a way to live vicariously in an idealized environment where they don't have to deal with all of the sinful and distracting challenges of today, like poverty or full-time jobs or two jobs or women that must work out of the home. So a lot of the social issues that are so important to evangelicals in our general culture and our politics are kind of airbrushed out of the Amish environment. Now, we know that's not true. Of course, Amish families have to deal with many of the same social and cultural challenges that the rest of us do. But it's an idealized environment that evangelical women can assume and pretend that they live through. They can work out some of their belief challenges there.
So interesting that it's evangelical women, because the Amish treatment of women isn't famously even close to equal or progressive by any means.
Not at all. And I think that's one of the more fascinating aspects of these books and their popularity. So the women, the heroines, are often portrayed as, I don't know, willful and determined, but also godly. And their aspirations and independence always comes around to fulfilling traditional roles. So they end up mothers and wives and, you know, doing the difficult domestic labor. And instead of talking about those great difficulties or challenges, you know, seven children, they're looking at these as a blessing. So, again, it's a kind of a sentimental whitewashed understanding of women's independence.
Well, which romance novels do, right? You know, you're completely removed from your daily life of having to shop and take care of your kids by being whisked away to, you know, I don't know, the Middle Ages or the 19th century or Scotland.
Exactly. And I think there's both a physical and a time lapse that evangelical writers and readers can use to get some distance on their own lives. So I keep saying imaginary or idealized, this another world that is kind of perfect for their purposes, and they can both get that escape from the real world, but they can also imagine that it exists. It's over there in the Amish community.
We're speaking with Ann Newman. She wrote about the popularity of Amish fiction, or bonnet rippers, as they are often called, really big business in publishing, and she wrote about it for The Baffler. Who are some of the notable writers of Amish fiction?
The names are big. Beverly Lewis, Cindy Woodsmall, and probably my favorite is Wanda Brunstetter. So together, these three have sold about 24 million copies.
My goodness. Are they Amish? I mean,
No, they're all evangelical women. And they're really accessible women. They're stories. Are used to sell these books, and they're very savvy, productive writers. They have active Facebook pages and online social media, and we know their family history because in some ways that's a great way to sell these books. If you have any connection to Amish or Mennonites, that gives you some sort of credibility in this circle.
Well, were you able to determine whether or not any of these titles are endorsed by any way by the Amish community?
Yeah, you know, again, the authors, for the sake of credibility, say that they talk a lot about their Amish friends and their Amish or Mennonite roots. And they say that they have an Amish friend, unnamed, of course, who looks over their manuscripts In fact, I believe Wanda Brunstetter has put out a book with an Amish woman, so they've co-authored something together. But any tie that these women can show in their marketing and promotion of the books to the Amish or Mennonite community gives them kind of a credibility and standing, and it feeds a long-standing fascination with Amish and Mennonite culture.
By co-authoring a book with an Amish woman, you can say this is not cultural appropriation.
Absolutely. No, they are left off the hook on that one.
Well, what do you think? Is this cultural appropriation?
Absolutely. You know, anytime you're not really talking about the lives of these individuals, but kind of an airbrushed, idealized, evangelical environment, you're not talking about the Amish. You're using particular tropes or styles or fashions, hopes, and you're removing them from their real lives.
So they're not even accurate in many cases.
No, the clothing is often inaccurate. I think the authors go to great pains to be as close as they can, but they're also, you know, they're working within a genre that has particular demands. And I don't know that the readers really want accuracy. They want the semblance of accuracy.
Well, Ann Newman, fascinating. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
Ann Newman, she's a visiting scholar at the Center for Religion and Media at NYU and a contributor to The Baffler. And you'll find a link to read her article, wonderfully named, More Titillated Than Thou. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we are almost done for the day, and our exploration of the new Luddite is just about over. But before we go, we wanted to leave you with a little goodbye from the quintessential old-school Luddite, the grumpy but very relatable technophobe lamenting the way that the world used to be. This is Robert Skoglund of the Humble Fama, who has been called the Garrison Keillor of Maine, ranting as only a true Luddite can.
You've heard this before, but it's so true that you're going to hear it again. They do not make things like they used to. Nothing seems to last anymore. No matter what you buy, it seems that before you get it out of the wrapping paper, it becomes obsolete, or wears out, or breaks down, or runs down, so you have to buy another one. If there's an item that is an exception to this rule, it is my wife Marcia, the almost perfect woman who seems to grow tougher and more dependable with each passing year. But the purpose of my present commentary is not, as you probably suspected, to boast and brag about my wife, but to rant and rave about things that do wear out before they should. Case in point, the 6-volt battery in my Model T. You know the car I'm talking about. It's a good, dependable car, and you'd have to admit that it's given me good value when you consider that I paid $10 for it in 1951. Anyway, I recently bought a brand new battery from my friend Steve Corson in Rockland, but last summer I couldn't get it to hold a charge. I had to crank the engine to get the car going, so this week I took the used battery back and got the regular junk value for it when I traded it in on a new one. I was careful with that battery, so there's no reason it should not hold a charge. You know, in winters, I took it out of the car and left it on a board in my friend's heated garage. I'd been good to that battery, but it didn't seem to make any difference. But the one I just bought is guaranteed to last 30 months, so you better believe I'm going to hang on to that warranty paper this time. The young man in the store carried the new battery out to my car for me, and when he picked up the one I was trading in, he looked at the numbers on it and said, "Wow, most batteries won't last over 4 years, but you bought this one here in 1999. I'm Robert Skoglund in Tents Harbor, Maine.
They don't make them like they used to. You always used to say that's why everything you ever built is still standing here today. That old command.
Well, like the original Luddites, we have run out of road, and that's it for our show today. While talking through this idea, we discovered that the new Luddite exists on a spectrum, and we all rest somewhere along that range. There's a point when denying the tools and conveniences of the modern world becomes silly. Other points when embracing technology for its bright, shiny promise of time-saving or progress feels empty or impersonal, even tyrannical or something. So we'd like to know, where do you draw a line? What kind of new Luddite are you? The kind that fantasizes about living in a cabin without the internet, but couldn't possibly give up your smartphone for anything? The kind that despises social media, but loves binging on Netflix? Or maybe the one who supports the idea of local community economies, but does all your holiday shopping online? Help us map the new Luddite spectrum by sharing your tech habits on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Or if you refuse to use Facebook, you can give us a call on our listener line, 603-223-2448. After all, even the most rigorous of Luddites has to communicate sometime. Why not do it through word of mouth? I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio. Castle, but the